Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us today. It's a day to talk school. That's right. Everybody goes back to school one way or another here in this time of year. At some point, you have to go back to school, get your academics flowing again. So, to help with us, we brought in Dr. Matthew Haas. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning, Rick?
I'm doing well. Superintendent of Albemarle County Schools, as we talk about a new school year. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
The new superintendent of Albemarle County Schools. So you've changed jobs.
Yeah, I changed jobs about, close to 2 months ago at this point. July 1st, I followed Dr. Moran as this, and I'm the 20th superintendent of Albemarle County Public Schools.
Number 20?
Number 20.
Does that come with its own, like, plaque, or did somebody give you this gigantic acrylic 20
actually,
to put in the window?
Dr. Hairston, who I'm hoping will show up at some point this morning, our chief of community engagement, gave me a T-shirt that says Haas on the back and number 20. So occasionally I'll wear that.
Is that like a brew-through T-shirt or something?
No, it doesn't have any content. Just has my name and number 20, ACPS.
So, Dr. Haas, the 20th superintendent for Albemarle County Schools starting this school year. But like you mentioned, you're following Dr. Pam Moran, who just recently retired, mm-hmm. a very outgoing, very public superintendent. Not all superintendents... and I don't mean to make this specific to Albemarle, but you can go anywhere throughout the state of Virginia. You can probably go anywhere nationally. Not all superintendents have her personality. Some just rule from their chair, from their office. What's it like to follow that person, that personality?
I would say following Dr. Moran, the best word to describe that is humbling. It's been great working with Pam all these years that I did. She and Dr. Kastner hired me to be principal at Albemarle High School back in 2004. And ever since then, I've been observing and learning from Dr. Moran. I don't have the same personality that she does. I wouldn't describe myself necessarily as maybe as outgoing and one of the things I had talked to you earlier about was the difference between my old job and the job that I have now is there's a lot more talking involved. And Dr. Moran was a great communicator and is certainly very much a top-notch educator as well. I think she, I don't want to speak for Pam, but I would say that she would view herself as a teacher first, an educator first, and that as she would ascended into the job that she occupied for the last 13 years, she still held strong ties to that. She spent a lot of time out in the schools visiting classrooms to observe firsthand the work of teachers and students. And I think that heavily influenced the decision-making that she did. And I think she made great decisions for Albemarle County Public Schools. So part of my job is to carry on her legacy, the legacy of the strategic planning and the vision of the board, and to keep the good things that she started and continued to keep them going well as I move forward.
When did it become your goal, Dr. Haas, goal to become a superintendent?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I started teaching in 1990 in Virginia Beach. I was in junior high school English teacher.
Oh, wow. A junior high school?
Yeah, back in the day, we had junior high schools there. And also a high school English teacher, coach. I have a bus driver's license, so I can drive a school bus. And,
now your sound is starting to sound like my dad.
How so?
Oh, he drove the bus. That's right. Played on the baseball team. Mm. I drove the bus.
When you coach back then, it was a little different. When at least in Virginia Beach, it was different. When you coached, if you got your bus driver's license, you could drive your athletic team. So I coached wrestling and track and field. So when we had matches and meets, I would drive the team, and then
that's
I drove.
Saving money, that's yeah. Efficiency.
Well, back in the day, when you're starting out on a teacher's salary in those days. It really helps a lot in terms of paying off my debts and things like that to have a little extra income. So I had the chance to drive the bus, and it was a good opportunity to talk with the team on the way there.
That's
and,
cool.
Yeah, it was fun. But you know, back in those days, my goal was to be a teacher, and I had jobs in the summertime, and you know, I'd paint houses or work temp jobs. And I met my wife. She was an English teacher at the same junior high school, and we're both teachers. And at some point, after we got married and started talking about having kids and what kind of life we wanted to have, we decided that she would stay home with children if we ever had them. And so I started looking into an administrative job, because then I could work 12 months and make some extra income. So that's really just how I got into being an administrator. And I became an assistant principal in 1998. And from that point on, I've just had great mentors and role models that have been administrators in the schools. I worked for a great principal that I consider to be very effective was Jim Walker at Plaza Junior High School and Middle School. Al Williams was principal at Kellam High School where I was there. Dr. Tonelson, just person after person that I looked up to them, and I saw them as very effective in advocating for students and mentoring young people, working with teachers really effectively. And I started to have a desire to want to do that work. So I was principal of a very small high school out in Smith County, Virginia. It's in Saltville, probably a place that most of your listeners have never been to. It's out near Tazewell County, almost in Tennessee.
I have family in Tazewell.
There you go. So you know where Saltville is. And then I came here, and I went to the central office in 2009, and I didn't really have a lot of contact or work directly with Dr. Moran. But as I worked there, she started to give me more and more responsibilities and really coached me. And probably about 3 years ago, I started to think about what it would be like to be a superintendent seriously, because it's a big change. You know, it's a different kind of commitment. And so I've been very fortunate to work for her. She's a great mentor. She wasn't stingy about sharing responsibilities and communication with the board, which is one of the biggest challenges that you can have early on, is learning how to work effectively with a school board. She gave me lots of opportunities to do that. So I think it was part being around long enough to and learn what I needed to learn to become qualified for the job, and then also seeing someone like Pam who was highly effective in that role and wanting to make that kind of contribution to the county.
That's great. Our guest today, Dr. Matthew Haas, he's the new superintendent this school year of Albemarle County Schools. We also have with us Dr. Bernard Hairston. He's the Chief of Community Engagement at Albemarle County Schools. Good morning.
Good morning.
Maybe I should turn your microphone on. So let's try that again.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for joining in today. We're glad to have you here. My first question to you is, I don't know the role. I know superintendent. I have an idea of what that does, but I don't know what the role of community engagement, the chief of that. Can you tell me what that role is?
I describe my role as the absolute best in Albemarle County Public Schools. I have had the pleasure of actually creating the role after being promoted from principal of Burley Middle School. To develop the responsibility based on just a general outline that was presented of being a strategic planner for the division, as well including the mission, vision, and goals of the school division while interacting the community within those goals. And so much of my work over the last several years focused on the initial five goals that we had in the division and focusing on those areas where I felt the community could have the greatest impact on the areas where we had the greatest need. So essentially, my job is interacting with the community to support the work of the division, superintendent, strategic goals, outcomes, missions, vision, et cetera, et cetera. So it's pretty broad.
That is pretty broad. So do you ever go home at the end of the day feeling like you've accomplished the job? Because I would feel like that there's so much on my plate, I could never have checked a box and say, whew, I can go home and have a beer.
I go home each and every day thinking that I have had an impact on someone. You know, as educators, we have one of the most important jobs. And if we can't say that we have done something positive with students each and every day, then we should not be in the job. So, you know, just a point of emphasis, rather than say, how you doing? You know, a good point of emphasis may be, so what are you going to do today to impact change on someone's life? You do that at the beginning of the day with someone, rather than say, good morning, tell me what you're going to do to impact the life of someone else. By the end of the day, you ask them, what did you do? So each and every day, I go through that exercise. And I'm quite surprised. Because if you tend to focus on the outcomes rather than those that you're not able to do, you realize that you're doing a whole lot more than what you anticipate. We oftentimes focus on the negative rather than the positive.
It's 12 minutes after the hour today as we're talking about the new school year with our superintendent, Dr. Haas, and the chief of community engagement, Dr. Hairston. So let's start by talking about the first 100 days tour that's going on, because I believe you are both involved in this. Dr. Hairston, you are chairing this process. Is that correct?
I have been anointed to do that job and to lead that work. Absolutely.
And then, Dr. Haas, you are sitting in the chair. Let's see. I have the four or the three part. You're learning, clarifying, reporting, and affirming
right
on these.
So first of all, I'd say I love working with Dr. Hairston. And so when back when I was started talking with the board about taking on the role of superintendent and interviewing with them, one of the things that I offered them was an outline for a listening tour or a transition plan. Because I wanted them to understand that even though I've been in the system for 14 years, I was concerned that I could develop blind spots over that time and get used to the way things are and not just want to transition and walk down the hall, hang my name up, and pick up right where we left off. So I offered them an outline, but I didn't have a plan laid out. And so after the board named me to be the superintendent, I had a conversation with Dr. Hairston, and because of his key role in the Office of Community Engagement, I knew he had the skill set and also the community relationships to really flesh out the plan to do a listening tour, which really the idea would be that we would set up opportunities for community members, staff, parents, and students to tell us how things are going in the school system, what's going well, what are the things that we need to do better or maybe do more of or less of, and then to offer me specific advice about being a good superintendent. And so Dr. Hairston worked with a team to put together a charter or a really detailed plan, laid out, I think we started out with maybe 15 or 16 sessions that would start in July with various groups. And we still have a couple more to go. And of those sessions, when we hear the feedback that we hear, we're compiling it. We'll put together a community-wide survey to send out for all the people that maybe couldn't make it and wanted to have input. We have a link on the webpage where people can send in emails and make comments. And we're going to report to the board what we've learned through the listening tour so that they get feedback as well. We'll use what we affirmed through the survey to then develop a plan because I have to look at my job differently now than I used to, where I have a four-year contract. It's not some indefinite amount of time to hope that things are going to turn out a certain way. I have a specified amount of time to get things done, and I want to be sure that I have a green light from the school board that I'm going to be working on the right things in that position.
And Dr. Harrison, what was your goal for this? How did you envision the listening tour when you were setting it up?
So my first question was, why did Dr. Haas ask me to oversee this? And I just reflected and came to the conclusion that he has heard my rhetoric over and over again, that whatever we do must be driven by our one goal, and that is to prepare all of our students as 21st century learners. And whatever that goal is, in supporting that goal, everything that we do must be aligned to that single goal, and there should be accountability for our actions day to day. So I drew the conclusion that he was tired of hearing my rhetoric on that over and over again, and he put me in charge to make sure that his plan would be rolled out effectively. So
I'm never tired of Dr. Harrison's rhetoric.
So in terms of the plan, it was about structure. It was about rolling it out so it would be unique to other opportunities to engage our stakeholders, to give advice to the new superintendent, because his vision was to listen to his new stakeholders, to get their understanding of our current state to influence his strategic planning as their superintendent. And so when I thought about doing this work, it's all about, well, let's create some steps so that the opportunity to listen to these folks who attend would be connected somehow. So, for example, with the sessions that we have in place, there are a series of questions. So, Rick, tell me what you think are some of the bright spots for you as a parent or a teacher or a student in Albemarle County Public Schools. And in a small setting, 10, 15, 20 folks, you would share your opinion. Others would listen. Second question, what do you think are areas that we can improve upon? You share your thoughts, your ideas. Others will listen. Then the most important piece, the third piece, tell us about how you take these conversations of different views and provide some suggestions to our new superintendent how we can impact our goal, which is serving our students effectively through some systemic change.
And so who's taking notes on all this?
Ah, that's part of the process. You're a bright man. So if we have, like, you know, 60 people, and we have had as many as 60 people, so we put them in small groups. We have a facilitator in each of those groups. We have a note taker while Dr. Haas is jumping from group to group, just kind of getting a snapshot of whatever they're saying, taking his personal notes. But we have a facilitator and a note taker taking real detailed notes about the comments that are made. Those notes have been transcribed. The next step is to use our folks in staff positions who can analyze data, categorize the data, and to put it in some sort of format so that we can then look at how we can compact all of that for useful information for long-range planning.
Again, our guest today, as we talk about the new school year, specifically in Albemarle County Public Schools, we're hearing Dr. Bernard Harrison, the Chief of Community Engagement, as we jump into talking about the first 100 days listening tour. We also have Dr. Matthew Haas. He's taken over superintendent in the first 100 days here in Albemarle County. Hang tight. Obviously, we have lots going on and lots to talk about. Be right back. All right, here we are back talking about the first 100 days in the listening tour and how Dr. Matthew Haas is figuring things out in this new job, specifically with the help of the county, at the assistance of Dr. Bernard Hairston, getting it going with this listening tour, learning and clarifying, reporting and affirming. Dr. Hairston, as far as this tour goes, a lot of times when someone like Dr. Haas goes around and says, let me hear your thoughts on this, what we often see or hear about are the people who we get their thoughts about are the ones who yell the loudest. How do you prevent something like that from happening in this, especially when you talk about, as someone who comes from a family of educators, it's the parent who is the loudest or who complains the most. So I'm curious as to, in this sort of situation with the parents being involved, what do you do in that situation to make sure that it is the proper sort of communication going on?
So first, we train our facilitators to expect that and to encourage everyone's voice to be heard, and to, in a very polite way, when we were experiencing that sort of rhetoric, knowing that it has been a pattern oftentimes that we tend to gripe about issues, but to facilitate a change in the dialogue, and we want everyone to speak. We have a certain amount of time dedicated to those questions that guided the discussion. 15 minutes, for example, on bright spots. You may have, 15 to 20 people speaking. And so we asked them to be respectful of everyone's voice. And that, it actually worked out. I was a little concerned with some of that about, regarding people just kind of sharing some of their personal concerns and going on and on. But as I looked at the notes that have been recorded, I've been really, really impressed with how we've stayed on point. So it has been really impressive with how we've moved through these sessions to get the information that we're looking for that's useful.
Dr. Haas, I'd like to get now from the person sitting in the chair who has everybody else sort of swirling around you and your head going from group to group to group. I'd like to get your viewpoint on this in terms of, what are you picking up? Is there a topic that keeps coming to mind or you keep hearing about most?
So it's we really have a great lesson plan, or we call it a protocol, for these approaches. So really my role is to circulate, and I use my phone to jot down notes that I'm hearing. And then at the end of the session, we put everybody together in one big group, and I share what I heard, even though we do have recorders there. And so it depends on the audience. For example, some of the positives that we hear from parents and students is that they really love the teachers that we have in the school system, that they really appreciate the teachers. They think we do a great job with recruiting and hiring teachers. Depending on the group we may be meeting with, like for example, last week we had a special meeting with a group that was primarily focused on equity in the school system. One of the things we heard was they love the teachers. They want to see more diversity in our teaching core.
That mean you're talking about more African American teachers, more different cultures in the teaching?
I think both. And having said that, I think that our teaching core, our teaching staff, should be more reflective of our student population. Our students in Albemarle County Schools are about 10% African-American students, 12% Latino students, and we have very few African-American educators in the county. It fluctuates between 1% and 2% of our teachers are African-American. So while parents, students, and teachers themselves appreciate other teachers, their colleagues, that's an area that we've heard that we could work harder on. And also, while we do a good job, I think, of hiring for diverse candidates, we need to do a better job of retaining these candidates, because it doesn't do good it doesn't do very much good to hire, like we just did, 16% of our new teachers that just came in are minority teachers of various backgrounds. However, it's difficult to retain these teachers because the majority population of teachers that we have doesn't really reflect everyone's background. But we hear a lot of great things about our teachers, our principals, the support staff that we have. We hear positives about our facilities and how well maintained they are. Students in particular gave us feedback about their teachers, and one of the things that resonates with me was something we've been working on. A student commented in one session that was primarily for students that he really liked his teacher, and that the best teachers that he had are teachers that share their background with the students, that talk about how they grew up, how they became interested in being a teacher, why they like being a teacher, what their family is like, so that students could get to know them and have a better connection with them. And that's one of the components of culturally responsive teaching, which is a growing emphasis for Albemarle County Schools. We also hear from our teaching staff that, and we've heard from parents, that as a division, while we are a progressive school system and we've got lots of new ideas and innovations, they want to be part of the information gathering, the idea process, the listening process at the ground floor of these changes that we are proposing and then we carry out, especially changes that have to do with school facilities. Teachers would like to know what is the problem that we're working on addressing by, for example, opening up classrooms and going from having maybe two classrooms to combining them into one large space. And we have good reason for that, but it would be helpful for teachers to be part of the conversation early on and try to figure out what it is we're working on. And I will say this, one of the pieces that Bernard included in these sessions is that people then get to give me advice on being a superintendent, you know. So I hear things ranging from don't change, you know, keep listening. One third grader at Agner Hurt, when we did the session over there, looked right at me and just said, "I've got advice for you." And I said, "Okay, what is it?" And he said, "If you have a decision that you're going to make for students, just make it." That was his advice. I think those are great words to live by.
To get it, I love that. That's awesome. Again, we are talking about the new school year. Our guest, Dr. Bernard Harrison, he's the chief of community engagement, who had a big part in chairing the process for the first 100 days listening tour that we're currently discussing with Dr. Matthew Haas. He's the superintendent of Albemarle County Schools. We're talking about diversity and with the teaching system. We were talking about retaining. How does Albemarle County, instead of just retaining and hiring, can you reach out to actually recruit or find teachers? Mm-hmm. Is that a possibility? Is that something that is even done public school system?
So let me answer that question, Dr. Haas. I was going to jump in, but a part of my work with community engagement, in terms of initially identifying some of those areas where there was a need, we created a partnership with the African American Teaching Fellows Program. Has been our go-to organization for recruiting African American teachers. But that's just one tool that's working. We are not doing the job that we should be doing with recruiting as well, retaining our minority teachers. And so the whole purpose of this listening tour is to identify areas of need such as that, and to do some things that we haven't been doing over the last years that's not working, and to truly look outside of the box to be able to not only recruit but to retain our minority teachers and staff if we are truly invested in it. We have talked about this and talked about it, and we just have to do some things differently. So, for example, I decided to shift my hat from to a participant in one of our smaller sessions, and I put out a recommendation, okay, just to promote some thinking in terms of a possible systemic change relative to recruiting and retaining. So why not why not establish relationships with some of our community business partners to provide a bonus for any current staff who can successfully recruit a minority teacher to support a division policy that will say that if we have 5% of our students who are Asian, then 5% of our teachers should be Asian. So we set up a system where we have our community to sponsor a bonus for teachers who can recruit an Asian teacher to meet our population and supplement their pay at a given amount to do that. That's outside of the box thinking when we can't accomplish this goal. We're competing against all the other school divisions in this area and the state for the limited number of minorities who are qualified. And Alamar County is one of those school divisions where we're at a we have an advantage over so many other school divisions. So 7% of our teachers are African American. That's not good enough. Okay, and it varies from school to school. So we have to do some things differently.
What about the fact that Albemarle County is in itself an expensive place to live for an Albemarle County school teacher? Does that get in the way of retaining teachers?
I think that we don't really have data that supports that. I think that there is a lot of conversation around that. We've done some surveys in the past around teachers and some of the things that I think that may impact our retention of an Albemarle County teacher might be some of the policies that we have in place around teachers perhaps living somewhere else and then bringing their children into the school system. Right now we have a rather expensive fee that's associated with that. They're allowed to do it. However, that was one thing that came up at a listening tour session the week before last or last week.
Is that a tuition fee?
It's a tuition fee. So Albemarle County Schools does not accept students from outside the school system at all, except if you are a county employee. So it's considered a benefit to county employees to be able to bring their children into the system. However, the rate at which they're charged is half of the local contribution to the average per pupil expenditure that we have, which is the total for that is in around $13,000 a year. Then the local part of that is about $9,000, and then half of that's about $4,500. So we charge $4,500 per child to come into the system. So that came up as something that may be inhibiting our ability to have a diverse teaching staff of people that live outside the county and come in to work here because they really can't afford for their children to come here, which impacts their attendance. You know, it impacts their just day-to-day life. I think that we worked pretty hard over the past couple years to address the cost of living, the cost of expenses here in the county. We had heard from many, many teachers that their pay just simply wasn't helping them to make that affordable. So we brought in a consultant to study our compensation package and compared that to other school systems that we compete with. And we came up with a series of recommendations from the consultant that we've been carrying out. For example, last year, this can be kind of difficult to explain without a picture, but we had established a scale where our teaching pay scale, where we're basing it on our competitive market, but we were basing it on 4 points on the scale. So the scale kind of had a bend in the middle. It was concave because we were more competitive at places like 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. So annually, when we put in our pay increase, those teachers got less of a pay increase than the teachers at the other places on the scale where we weren't as competitive. One of the recommendations of the consultant was to straighten the scale out so that when we say we're going to give a 3% raise or a 2% raise, every employee gets the same raise. So we did that last year, and we put in the 2% raise, which equated to many teachers getting over 5% pay increase last year, which was that's a big increase compared to what we've been doing annually prior to that. And then moving forward, we've got a better scale. It's more equitable across the scale. So I think that will have an impact. We're also working on a couple of other things to increase the stipends that we give teachers for extra duties, especially teaching an extra class, things like that. So we have heard, and but having said that, there's not exactly data that we can put our finger on that says, well, I'm not taking a job in Albemarle County because I can't afford to live there.
Well, you did get the, I can see where the issue about tuition might be a point, especially when if you want to bring your child into the county with Albemarle County schools just being put into the top 2% nationally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's quite an honor.
So, Rick, I think that we need consistent rhetoric relative to systemic change. And let's just deal with the bottom line issue here.
Well, wherever the tuition rates is, let's talk about Albemarle County being put into the 2% right. nationally. That's quite an honor.
That's my point. Albemarle County is an exceptional school division. But the bottom line is teachers are underpaid. That's the bottom line. And so, when we talk about a 2% raise across the board, Dr. Haas here had to be very creative with the board last year to figure out a way to get it up to 5%. But generally, the raise has been around 2%, 3%. That's unacceptable. I mean, when we have political candidates every year who advocate for teacher raises, but nothing changes. So we really need to respect those people who go into education and pay them accordingly. That is the bottom line issue in terms of what we need to do in this community for systemic change. Pay teachers appropriately.
Dr. Harrison, again, I come from a family of educators. You're not going to convince me of anything except teachers are underpaid.
Push it out there.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Matthew Haas, he's the superintendent of Albemarle County Schools, and Dr. Bernard Harrison, he's the chief of community engagement, wanting to engage everybody that teachers and everybody in the public school system is underpaid. As we talk about the new school year, not quite 38 minutes after the hour. But let's take a minute because I need to take a break and just two. That Albemarle County Schools did just get the Niche report?
Right.
And Western Albemarle High School was voted the top athletic school in the entire state of Virginia. I found that to be amazing. I mean, especially because Northern Virginia high schools always win something. I mean, they're always number one. But Albemarle County Schools, top 2% nationally, and Western, best in the state athletically.
Well, first of all, we're really proud of all of our schools, all of our teachers, all the administrators in the schools for helping us to be one of the top-ranked school divisions in the nation, as well in the top 2% in Virginia. That's quite an accomplishment. And the Niche rankings look at test scores, but they look at all the other factors, all the other things that you put in place around health, safety, administration, and as you pointed out, extracurriculars like athletics. And it doesn't surprise me that Western was in the top of the heap in the state, because across all their sports, whether it's young men or young women, they have very successful programs, individuals and teams.
All right, let's take this break. Yep. We shall be right back. All right, back in action with the gentleman from Albemarle County School System. Making funny jokes here in the background. All right, and so here we are again with Dr. Haas and Dr. Harrison talking about the new school year at Albemarle County. But don't forget, everybody's going back to school somewhere for some reason. Let me bring up a question about what's going on locally. Dr. Harrison, you lead a group of students and outside talking about anti-racism policy for the school division, correct?
I have I initiated a discussion group on racism back in February and March of this past year as a result of public comments brought before the school division. This informal group met at least three times, of which we talked about how do we confront racism in our schools. And policy was one of those areas that surfaced as a way of confronting racism. And this group suggested that we look at dress code policy as a way of unpacking how we can confront racism. We have done some initial work, still have more work to do on that dress code policy. But a stronger suggestion, in my opinion, that came from that group was to or is to develop a policy on anti-racism. I believe that policy has more potential impact on changing some of these systemic structures that we're talking about. So we are in the middle of a twofold policy change, the dress code and anti-racism policy.
You started by working with students, correct?
Parents.
You started
a,
with
a small
parents.
Discussion group that consisted of, we I think it was in February, a parent had a passionate voice about experience with her, her child, and I approached her following her comment and asked, you know, would you be open to maybe formalizing a group that we can talk about this as a parent? And this person said, oh, absolutely. May I bring someone on board? And the conversation evolved around, well, you know, I can bring some folks at my level to sit around the table to have this discussion. So it began with a group of parents. And so with the dress code policy, now I'm working with a group of students on the anti-racism policy, because we part of what I've done within the school division for the last several years is to address culturally responsive teaching and develop cultural competencies. And so this summer we had a two-week summer leadership academy with a group of students, and we developed curriculum that would introduce them as student leaders on what cultural competencies should look like for a student leader. And as we evolved in this anti-racism policy of developing one, that group just surfaced as a group that we could engage students into real world problem-based experiences. And so we have an outside facilitator, a UVA a PhD student who has a real, who's one of our parents, has a real strong background in coursework. She's taught a couple classes in race, ethnicity. She's done research on racism, institutional racism. And she has been tasked to facilitate this problem-based experience for students to develop this policy. And I've been quite impressed with the work that's been done thus far. They've met at least four times. She's working with them through how do you research? What does a good policy look like?
Well, let me ask you this. I brought this up because, so let's get the true answer here, because the news has reported a group of parents is pushing Albemarle County schools to ban students from wearing Confederate imagery. True or not true?
That is true, but that is a dress code issue that we're confronted with. Absolutely.
And, that's partially true. As Dr. Harrison said, when we first engaged some parents, there were two parents that wanted to be or were invited to be part of a discussion group. After these parents were involved in the discussion, then they evolved their perspective into a larger group. It's like hate-free schools or something like that. And so that may contain some parents that live in Albemarle County, but it also the group that was at the board meeting the other night was comprised of people that they bussed in from Orange County, from North Carolina, from other places. And so we went from working with a couple of parents that are we consider to be stakeholders in the school system to people that are activists from outside the school system that are pushing a particular agenda with us. I think that, at least from my perspective, that the Confederate flag, in many respects, does not have a place in a school in Albemarle County. Having said that, students themselves have a right to free expression, and they don't, as we know from the Tinker versus Des Moines case many years ago, it's the Supreme Court standard. Students do not shed their constitutional right to expression when they come through the door. That has not changed. This group has proposed that there are decisions that have been made in the Fourth Circuit that impact the Tinker versus Des Moines decision, but they do not. And we still need to look at it from that standard, from that legal standard. And also, we need to protect our students' right to express themselves, all students. When we engage in viewpoint discrimination and say that a student cannot come into school and express themselves for one particular symbol, then when do we stop? What's the next symbol that we're going to say a student cannot use to express themselves, to where we get to a very to an environment where students' rights are chilled and they just come into school and they're not active participants? So that's a big concern for me as a superintendent. I want to be sure that we make decisions as a school administration and also as a school board that protect students' rights. We say that we want students to be ready to take on the next step when they graduate, to be lifelong learners, to be great employees, to be great citizens. And I don't think we can achieve that effectively if we go into a police state where we begin to dictate specifically how students can express themselves when they come into our schools. I think that our board is moving forward and handling this appropriately. They're taking their time. They're being thoughtful about it. I think that it's a mistake to make decisions quickly just because one group says you must act now, you must do something now. Most of the time, that's not really the case. Most of the time, there really is time to have thoughtful discussion, to do the research, to make a good decision for 14,000 students. Acting now is sometimes just a way to get a board to move forward without being completely thoughtful about it.
How does Albemarle County teach current events and politics in this current world?
Well, for one thing, we do have a school board policy that's it's called teaching about controversial issues. And one of the first things that policy says is we want students to engage in controversial issues, but we want to be sure that it's a balanced conversation. We encourage our teachers to have open-ended discussions with their students about current events. And in my opinion, it's easier than ever because of as I pointed out earlier, I began teaching in 1990. Dr. Hairston began teaching in 1975. Back in those days, what did you do? You brought in newspaper clippings, things like that. Now, students have laptops. They have all kinds of technology. They know what's going on at the very moment, whether it's a revolution in another country, whether it's protests in the United States. They can be engaged with that, and the teacher is there to ask questions, to facilitate, and to encourage students to really engage in deep learning around that.
But to me, the question would be the difficulty of the teacher remaining or not choosing sides or not arguing or with a student and saying, that's not true, you're wrong, read that again. For the veracity of the, that website is misleading you, and that sort of thing when it comes to the teaching moments.
And that's why it's about lifelong learning, that really the teacher's role is not necessarily to say what's correct or incorrect or politically correct or politically incorrect. The teacher's role is to ask the right questions, to frame up the lesson or frame the experience so that the student can explore what they want to learn about a particular topic. And as you pointed out, Rick, you know, it is a teacher's role to help students develop criteria and make determinations around the veracity of a particular web page or who sponsors that page. And there are facts. It is true that there are facts and there are things that are not facts. And so it's a teacher's role to help students get a factual understanding of the world.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Matthew Haas, superintendent at Albemarle County Schools, Dr. Bernard Hairston, the chief of community engagement. Dr. Hairston, you mentioned earlier that you want everyone to be a 21st century learner, but I never asked you to define that.
So that is the division, a goal. We have one goal, and that's to prepare all of our students to be 21st century learners. And so we can interpret that based on a lot of different factors relative to how we go about educating students. So when you asked a question about a teacher being able to engage in a lesson on the Confederacy or current events from a neutral perspective. So in preparing a student as a 21st century learner based on our expectations of teacher training, we say that we want our teachers to prepare our students as independent learners, creative thinkers. So if I'm a history teacher and I'm having a conversation about the Confederate image, I might say, well, let's look at the history that was written by this white author back in 1870 and the perspective. And then let's compare and contrast a very similar article that was written by a scholar in 2010. And so as a teacher, I'm not sharing my opinion, but I'm teaching my students to be independent learners, to be able to function within this global society that's very, very diverse. So it's just no one answer, but it's about being ahead of the curve as educators, because we know that our students are going to have totally different experiences than we're having today.
All right. There we go. Now I have my definition. Thank you very much.
It's very broad.
Well, that's one thing that I think doesn't happen enough is people go to one place, one website, they only subscribe to one newspaper, one magazine. It's all one side of whatever, you know, whatever you want to call it, the middle point, and they only read one side of it, today's articles. There's no history. There's no, you know, if you're right wing, you don't read the left wing. You don't, or you just blow it off and you say, that's not true.
Teaching is not a package deal, okay? It's about individualizing for every student. It's about knowing about their background and experiences and differentiating and individualizing what you know about them, and that's why teachers should be paid a whole lot more.
That's right. That's the truth.
Got to plug it.
Again, our guests, Dr. Haas and Dr. Hairston from Albemarle County Public School Systems. We've got a few minutes left. Some of the things that did happen this first week of the school year, there's a 35,000 square foot addition at Woodbrook Elementary School. How many extra kids were at Woodbrook that you needed that large?
Okay, so that's a great question. So the real issue that brought about the expansion of Woodbrook was the Greer was overpopulated by student, you know, the student population, and continues to grow. And also, while Agnor Hurt was at capacity, it's another growing school. Woodbrook was the one school in this vicinity that actually had the space around it to make additions to it, and it was also due for renovation work, some modernization work. So the plan was to add to Woodbrook, modernize the school facility, and then transfer students from Greer and Agner Hurt. So the addition to the student population at Woodbrook will be in the neighborhood of 200 students from those other two schools, nearly doubling the size of the population at Woodbrook.
Wow.
They did also, Rick, add a new gym to the school and took the space that was the old gym and transformed it into classroom space.
You completed controlled access entrances at all of for school
That's
security?
Right. Yeah, it was a project that's taken, I think, around 4 or 5 years to have at every school, instead of just entering, many of our schools, you would just enter straight into the front door and then have access to the whole school from there. We began about 4 or 5 years ago changing those access routes so that you have to come through the main office to get into the school. So then we did finally complete that. I think Henley and Murray were the last schools for that were done this summer.
Updated science labs at all the high schools?
That was one of the areas that we looked at with our strategic plan, as well as we had a consultant look at all of our high school programs as part of the High School 2022 project to upgrade, renovate, and have science labs that allow for greater flexibility, more teacher collaboration, and just seem more like a workplace where students actually do science work.
Modernization of Murray High School.
Murray High School,
How
yeah.
far behind was that school?
Well, Murray High School actually had an improvement to its entranceway and a lot of lab work that was done. I wouldn't say it was behind. It just needed a big upgrade around access to technology tools and just a better space and as you come in and renovation to the front office. That's definitely an up-and-coming charter school in the area. It's been around a long time, and it's really going through a great refresh with the program with Chad Ratliff as the principal there.
And where is the next listening tour? That's the last question. We have 1 minute to go here.
It's our last, hopefully. There may be one other. It's the listening tour for our classified staff, and it's going to be at Elmore High School, I do believe.
I think September 6th.
So I can't show up?
Oh, yes, you can.
It's open to everyone, but we put out a specific invite to the classified staff so that they know about it and can prioritize it.
So anybody who's listening can show up. What's the day and time?
It's at 6 o'clock on September 6th at 6 o'clock at Albemarle High School, and it's specifically targeted to our classified staff. We have done sessions specifically for teachers, for community, for students, and for special groups.
But if you haven't been able to go,
you can.
Now's your time.
There is a place online called Online Feedback. So if you'd like to go on and say, Dr. Haas, I think this is a wonderful idea, go to the website, look under Superintendent's First 100 Days.
I've got him under my wing here. I can catch him on the way out. But not everybody's had that chance.
Yep. Yes.
All right. Thanks to you both
for coming in
today.
Thank you very much.
And you can listen to the podcast, everybody, SeavillePodcast.com. Thanks, gentlemen. Have a great time on your new tour. Dr. Haas, welcome to your new job.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.